rise. The court, the Minnesota Court of Appeals is now in session. Judge Sleater, Chief Judge Frisch, Judge Smith, the Honorable Randall J. Sleater presiding.
Good morning. You may be seated. And welcome to the Court of Appeals, June 11. This is the first of three oral matters we're considering this morning. The first matter is file number 825-0186. Craig Stevenson et al. Is the appellant. Sean Stevenson et al. Respondents. And a few usual housekeeping reminders, counsel. We are live streaming as well as recording these proceedings, so we do ask that you identify yourself and who you represent before you begin your oral comments. We ask that you keep an eye on the clock on the podium for the time, and also you can adjust the podium for your comfort as well. And no other recording is allowed absent prior approval. So with those comments, counsel for appellant, you may approach, identify yourself, and begin.
Thank you, Your Honors. May it please the court, counsel. My name is Matthew Scott. I represent appellants Craig and Marie Stevenson. I appear today as a lawyer, but also as a former law clerk. So I know firsthand the critical role that law clerks play in this process, not only at the district court level, but at the appellate level as well. It's part of the fabric of our system in Minnesota. It allows decision-making to occur in an efficient manner, where there's a supervisor, essentially the judge, and there's also someone who can do the real work on the ground, the research, the legal research that needs to be done. There's so much work to be done at the district court level. We saw that in this case. Judge Miller really has a lot of cases to deal with and to work through. You can see that by just looking through IMCRO, how many cases he deals with on a monthly and an annual basis. This appeal is not an attack on law clerks, but it's a recognition the indispensable influence that a law clerk has, and that where there's an undisclosed relationship, even an innocuous one, that undermines the appearance of fairness and public confidence in the judicial branch. By acting here, the court can give clear guidance to district court judges and clerks alike. Transparency and timely disclosures are essential to preserving the public's trust in this institution. This is not an actual bias case. This is an appearance of bias case. I want to be very clear about that. This is not something where, and the case law is clear in that regard as well. We have cases like Powell and Lilleberg where the decision might have even been right, but the justices that were involved in those cases thought it was so important to preserve the integrity of this system that when there was an appearance of bias in a case like Powell or Lilleberg, Lilleberg involved sitting on a trustee board for a university. Powell involved, and it's very unique in this case, because we have some quotes from Justice Deaston. Justice requires the appearance of justice. In Powell, you had a Court of Appeals panel of three judges unanimously ruling, and that decision went forward. What the Supreme Court said is when they found out later that one of those judges had a relationship with a lawyer, a trust lawyer, at the same law firm as had argued at that appellate argument, that appearance of bias or connection to that law firm was enough to vacate that unanimous decision and make the parties go back and do it all over again. The Minnesota Supreme Court didn't say that decision was wrong. It didn't say that decision was against the law or contrary to law, but it said it was tainted. It was tainted by the appearance of bias. As you've read the briefs, Your Honors, this is we've really made three arguments. Disqualification, Judge Miller should have disqualified and recused. Second, there should have been a vacator of the 12 orders that were written by Clerk Morrison. And I say written by, I mean his initials were discovered after the fact on these orders in the PDF metadata. I've heard it said, well, they should have discovered this earlier. You should have figured out which law clerk, Judge Hansen, who is counsel's father, worked with And then you should have checked the metadata on the orders that were coming out in this case, many of which were very much opposed to the appellant's positions, including final judgment, including a ruling at summary judgment, which this court affirmed, which is interesting in that it mirrors Powell in that where there is a taint on the process at the district court level, there is a taint on the judicial branch. And this court should see that, recognize it, recognize the importance of a law clerk. In this instance, I don't think anyone is going to dispute how important law clerks are. I hear it when I go to bar functions. I hear it when I talk to judges. I hear it when I interview law clerks for jobs. This is not an attack on a law clerk, but it is a unique scenario. This is not going to come up on a regular basis in the state of Minnesota. We are not going to have a regular or a routine situation where the judge's daughter is opposing counsel and the judge's former law clerk ends up writing 12 decisions in that case, many of which are very much against the opposite party. Here, vacator.
Counsel, can I ask, if you were my former law clerk 5 years ago, you were my law clerk, could I sit on this appeal?
That would really be something that this court would have to wrestle with, and I think it does.
Well, yeah.
I think it does.
Let's wrestle. Okay, so I can't hear a case at any of my former clerks.
Your Honor, I've heard policies like for 2 years, my judge would not hear any case that I was assigned to. She would recuse herself. After 2 years, she would announce it to everyone. And if that was disclosed and if the party that was opposing in that appeal was okay with it, then that would be fine. What we didn't get the opportunity to do.
And if not, I would have to recuse?
If they objected, I would say that alone, your former law clerk arguing to you, mm-hmm. Yes, absolutely. If I just don't know how you can recognize the relationship that law clerks have to judges and not recognize that has to be disclosed.
Recused if objected to.
Not necessarily recused if the parties are okay with it.
No, I know, if objected to.
If objected to, absolutely.
Okay, I have to recuse.
Okay. I think the issue in this case, Attorney Hansen, at the very first hearing, said that her father wanted her to announce to everyone that she was the daughter of Judge Hansen. We were kind of surprised by that fact. In open court, we didn't have much time to think about it. No one objected at that point. But what we didn't have an opportunity to object to is these orders that started to be penned by the former law clerk for her father. And those orders started to come out, and Clerk Morrison started to be actively involved in this case. And it makes sense.
Counsel, I don't see that in the record, that the law clerk was writing the orders as you're describing them or penning the orders as you're describing them. They're signed by the judge, and I don't see any evidence in the record that the law clerk actually wrote these orders.
There's evidence in the record in the form of affidavits.
Affidavits from your client.
And affidavits.
Who has no firsthand knowledge as to whether this law clerk wrote the order.
And affidavits from our law firm.
And your law firm has no firsthand knowledge that this law clerk wrote the order.
We have firsthand knowledge of the initials of the law clerk. His name is in the metadata as the author of the PDF.
So on my orders or my opinions that are issued from this court, my judicial executive assistant is the author because she originated the document. Does that mean that she has authored the document or written the document?
She didn't sign it, but she probably did a lot of work to prepare it. And there is no dispute in this appeal that he wrote those decisions.
Why should we assume that the author, as you said, did a lot of work to write the opinion or the order? I mean, where's that in the record?
Well, that's a good question. But what this is the appearance of impropriety, appearance of bias.
Is that an appearance of bias, that someone has created a document that is ultimately signed by a judge?
Because if that person was the law clerk for the opposing attorney's father and his initials repeatedly appear in these orders, That is an appearance of bias. It's an undisclosed.
Why is that an appearance of bias?
If you look at the case law that we've cited, if a law clerk is engaged to a lawyer, we've cited multiple cases where the law clerk's relationships are imputed to the judge. And that is simply a recognition of the value the law clerks have and the role they play in the situation. We've quoted from various justices and different, even the former Solicitor General of the United States, indicating that he was a clerk for Justice Scalia. He didn't change his mind very often, but sometimes he did. And if a law clerk is biased, if a law clerk has loyalties that have not been disclosed, and that law clerk's initials show up on that document, then the appearance is that that law clerk had some influence or sway. And if that was not disclosed...
I don't understand that leap in logic, that just because somebody's initials may appear in the metadata of a document, and quite frankly, I don't know why you're searching the metadata of the document, but that's another question for another day. But I don't understand why that automatically translates to bias.
It doesn't automatically translate to bias.
Your burden as the appellant here to demonstrate that it does actually translate to bias?
No, it doesn't. It's the appearance of bias. If you look at the standard, it is a reasonable, objective observer. And so this court takes a de novo review of these facts. It steps back and says, what's reasonable?
Has there been any case anywhere in the country that has looked at similar circumstances involving a law clerk and just having the law clerk's initials on a document, and that automatically creates some sort of appearance of impropriety or partiality? I'm not aware of any. I'm just wondering if there isn't any such thing.
The law clerk's mere involvement when they have a bias that is not disclosed is enough for a court to remand.
Okay, go ahead. The Alaska case?
Yes, that case was remanded for findings that it should be, that if there was a connection between this law clerk and the lawyer, an engagement, that alone, if the law clerk had written an order or had participated in that process, that alone was enough to remand for determination as to whether the judge should be disqualified and the order should be vacated.
Isn't the problem that you have in with that argument here, though, is the record indicate there's no relationship between the law clerk and Attorney Hansen?
That has nothing to do with the analysis, Your Honor. The relationship is between the law clerk and the judge, and the appearance of impropriety when that law clerk...
Relationship with the judge who's retired, not involved in this case. So I'm not... When you talk about the appearance of a bias... appearance, and I look at it, that's why I'm trying to figure out how that appears to be bias.
If your son went to law school and appeared 3 years from now in front of a judge, a different judge, and your law clerk went to clerk for that judge, I just think it defies logic that a reasonable person, a reasonable lay person, would look at that scenario. If you told that story in the grocery store, 100 people out of 100 would think that is an appearance of bias, that is unfair. That is the standard here. It's a reasonable person standard. So it's not the relationship between the law clerk and Ms. Hansen. It's the relationship between a member of Ms. Hansen's family and that law clerk. So Clerk Morrison was part of Judge Hansen's judicial family. This is a small Otter Tail County courthouse. These people see each other all the time. This isn't a big Hennepin County 24 floors. This is a small courthouse where you're passing in the halls, where you know the bailiff. Counsel knows the bailiff at Otter Tail County Courthouse, the person checking in through security. What we have here, Your Honors, is we cited the case Scarsden. Scarsden is a case where the court reversed because the district court selectively cherry-picked facts. What we have here, and our third point, is State versus Malone. If a district court judge investigates the facts, if a district court judge goes out and becomes a witness or an advocate for those facts, that judge is disqualified. And the order that was issued is vacated. There's very clear case law on this. And in this case, Judge Miller started this hearing announcing new facts to everyone. This is in the transcript. He then doubles down and he puts those new facts into his order.
Do you object to the judge invoking those new facts? I mean, I understand that.
I didn't object to the judge saying, these are my new facts. No.
He indicated that on the record in front of you, right?
Yes.
And you didn't object at the time or after the fact?
No, Your Honor, I did not think it would be appropriate to object to Judge Miller's comments.
I mean, you're objecting to him now, so I'm...
I am, and we raised the issue with him before he even did that. We raised State versus Malone in our motion papers, and he still investigated his own facts. He then put them in an order.
Counsel, what is the... I mean, in the other cases, I think you're talking about... The investigation of facts is outside of a trial, for example. What is the process that you, if the facts are relevant, if understanding the employment history, et cetera, of a clerk for purposes of determining whether there is a disqualification or bias, if that's relevant, what is the process that you think should have been followed to identify that factual history about that clerk's experience? What should have happened?
What should have happened was there should have been no new facts introduced into the record by Judge Miller.
And how do those facts get into the record if they're relevant to the decision on, you know, a motion that someone has brought?
A different judge could hold a hearing with regard to Clerk Morrison. Clerk Morrison could testify. We could both have an opportunity to question Clerk Morrison. The adversary process was not used here.
Did you seek a hearing, I wonder? Or how did the...
No, we didn't. We didn't seek a hearing because Judge Miller, when we asked Judge Miller to recuse and to go through this process, he refused. He refused to respond to our letter, and he required us to file a motion to go through this whole process. We put in the facts that we had access to. May I briefly respond, Your Honor?
Yes, you may.
We put in the facts that we had access to at the time. This is a post-judgment, post-appeal proceeding where we didn't find this out until June of 2024. Way after the fact, finding out that these facts were, and we didn't have access to these facts. What should have happened is there should have been an adversarial process set up so that both sides could have had an opportunity to weigh the facts, to dispute the facts. But what Judge Miller did is he went out and investigated the facts, brought those into the proceeding, and under the cases we've cited, State versus Malone, that requires disqualification and vacator of that order. Thank you, Your Honor.
Thank you, Counsel. And you will have 5 minutes on rebuttal. Counsel for respondent, you may approach. And when ready, identify yourself and begin.
I'll leave it here then.
Is that the, oh wait, going up or down?
I think we'll just leave it here then. Thank you. May it please the court, counsel. I am Ross Tenniger. I'm joined by Attorney Kirsten Hansen, who we've heard a lot about. I'm here today on behalf of respondents Sean Stevenson, Renee Stevenson, Lisa Stevenson-Allen, and Ashley Anderson. Ms. Hansen, co-counsel, represents Sean Stevenson and Renee Stevenson only. We are asking this court to affirm the district court's decision, finding that a reasonable person would not question the court's impartiality based on Clerk Morrison's involvement. I'll begin with the foundational principle that was not covered yet, that a district judge is presumed to have discharged their duties properly. To overcome that presumption, appellants bear the burden of showing not merely a dissatisfaction with the outcome, but an actual affirmative basis to question the court's impartiality. And they must do so under an objective standard. It is not what appellants subjectively believe, not what a disappointed or a disgruntled litigant holds true, but what a reasonable, fully informed, objective person would conclude. And when we apply that objective standard to the record here, it is clear that the district court correctly found that a reasonable examiner would not question the court's partiality on these facts. With that governing standard in mind, we turn to its application in this case. Appellants argue that Clerk Morrison himself was disqualified due to his past relationship due to his past employment as a clerk with now-retired Judge Mark Hansen. As the district court noted in its order, Mr. Morrison began that clerkship with Judge Hansen in November of 2013. He continued until September 2016 when Judge Hansen retired. That entire clerkship lasted less than 3 years in total. Clerk Morrison then began working as a clerk with Judge Benson while still in Otter Tail County. But it was not until almost 6 years later, in August of 2022, when Clerk Morrison first became involved with this case. And this case had been going on since November of 2020. Appellants argue that since Clerk Morrison was previously employed with Judge Hansen and his daughter, Attorney Kirsten Hansen, is attorney for two of the four respondents, that Clerk Morrison is disqualified and that, therefore, it mandates vacature. But that argument breaks down quickly when you examine the basic facts surrounding the perceived disqualification. Clerk Morrison is not a family member of Attorney Hansen. There is no relationship between Attorney Hansen and Clerk Morrison at all, neither professional nor personal. As the district court found, whether the two
counsel, can I just ask you there? You just heard counsel for appellant say that's not relevant. How do you respond to that?
Well, I think the relationship between the two actors involved, the perceived disqualification, is directly relevant here. There is no direct relationship between Clerk Morrison and Attorney Hansen. And I think you have to look at that relationship, not the relationship between Judge Hansen and Clerk Morrison, because Judge Hansen is not involved in this case. It's Attorney Hansen who is involved in this case, and Clerk Morrison, who previously was employed by Judge Hansen, but that terminated 6 years prior. The two actors in this case, there's no direct connection, and whether they had even met was unclear at the time of this hearing, or at the time of the district court decided this case, or this decision. The district court carefully evaluated this highly attenuated association and rightly concluded it did not create an appearance of partiality.
Is there some permutation of these sort of this triangulated relationship that would create an appearance of impropriety?
I would say that without the actual connection between the two actors involved and nothing more, I would say no, simply because Judge Hansen's conflicts under 211 are not imputed to Clerk Morrison indefinitely. If there was a relationship between Ms. Hansen or Attorney Hansen and Clerk Morrison, then perhaps there could be an issue. But in this case, there's absolutely no relationship whatsoever. There's no familiar relationship. There's no financial benefit to Clerk Morrison. For all we know, Clerk Morrison might not have even known that Attorney Hansen existed at the time of this.
So your esteemed colleague is arguing that the law clerk of a judge essentially forever creates a conflict such that if there's an objection to the judge presiding over a case involving the law clerk, who former law clerk, that the judge has to recuse. You heard that argument.
I did, Your Honor.
And your response?
I don't believe it's factually accurate. I don't think there's any case law precedent or case law to support that anywhere in the country that I found.
I mean, I think that you're right in terms of actual bias, but what about the appearance of impropriety?
When you look at the case law, and we have to go outside of Minnesota generally for most of it, it's dealing with potential future employment, potential financial benefit, family members directly involved. It doesn't look to the past indefinitely. It's just an untenable standard that would be allow Rule 11, 211 to be brought up in nearly any case when you have conflicts going back to all your past employers. It would just be an unworkable standard, and every judge, every case would be subject to these motions endlessly because someone can say, well, they previously worked for somebody and they were, you know, my son's second grade teacher. I mean, you have these relationships in the past, but I go back to the standard that is the district courts are presumed to have discharged their duties properly. You have to assume that these courts are doing what they are sworn to do and what they understand their role is.
You would agree that there are actions that a law clerk can undertake that would create either actual bias or an appearance of impropriety?
Absolutely. And we talked about that, counsel talked about the Alaska case. I believe it's Vasca. In that case,
I was just going to ask you about that. Go ahead.
I believe there was the law clerk had disclosed a confidential memo to the prosecuting attorney's office, and along with a note or comment of some sort that said something along, look how hard I'm working for you. There's also a relationship between, I believe, her and somebody else in the prosecuting offices. So that would create an appearance of bias here.
Or an actual bias?
Or an actual bias, Your Honor. What we have is Clerk Morrison did his job. He did what he was hired to do, and he did it presumably well because he's still working there. Other than that, there's no, and I think counsel's been clear, there's no actual bias being alleged here. It's just simply that Clerk Morrison exists, therefore we're claiming that there's a bias here.
Can you speak to the process and the argument that there was independent fact-finding done here?
Well, I will respond to with what your question was earlier. I think that that is spot on. I don't see how a court could assess its own potential conflicts without looking into those intentional those conflicts. And like I'm sure the process is here, when a new law clerk gets involved with a case or a new law clerk is assigned to a judge, there are going to be conflict checks at that time. And none of those, no one ever brought this up. So therefore, you can presume that neither Judge Miller nor Clerk Morrison found a conflict there. And as far as the investigation goes, the Malone case, that was when the judge actually made comments to the parties and counsel that, and made suggestions that the state might want to actually call an additional witness. He was investigating an actual disputed fact regarding personal service of a Danko order on the defendant. That was a material fact in that issue in the case. Here, the alleged, and I don't even think it was an internal investigation or an outside investigation, independent investigation, I wouldn't even call it that. If you're going to bring these claims against the court has to be able to conduct its own conflicts checks. Otherwise, what's going to happen unless you have a right to appeal the court decision to the chief judge? But that wasn't done here. There was no request for hearing or otherwise.
What's the proper procedure when the judge announces in open court, here are the facts that I'm going to look at or that I've found that I've investigated and found are relevant to this inquiry?
I think you'd have to make an objection or an offer of proof at the time. I mean, it's just like if you're in trial, you have to address that stuff head on, or at the very least, file some type of brief or memorandum or motion after the fact, request the procedure to have it reviewed by the chief judge, go through that process, not immediately bring it to the appeal, and cite Powell as an ability to just do away with everything the district court judge. I mean, there's standards in place to do that. I guess I would focus on, I believe the Supreme Court's decision in Ray Jacobs shows that disqualification would not be appropriate here. In Jacobs, the Minnesota Supreme Court held that no disqualification was required where the judge's spouse was employed as an assistant county attorney. That same county attorney's office was prosecuting a criminal case proceeding before the judge. So his spouse was in that office. The Minnesota Supreme Court found that because the spouse had no personal involvement with the criminal case and no financial or reputational interest in the outcome, the judge's partiality could not reasonably be questioned under 211. The court emphasized that disqualification is not automatic and held that a reasonable examiner, fully informed, would not question the judge's impartiality. If such an ongoing, close, familiar relationship did not disqualify in Jacobs, the facts here fall well short of that threshold. Unlike Jacobs, there is no familiar relationship between Clerk Morrison and Attorney Hansen. There is no ongoing employment connection between Clerk Morrison and Attorney Hansen. There is no institutional overlap between this case and any case heard by Judge Hansen, and no allegations of bias, improper influence, or otherwise against Clerk Morrison. All he did was work as he was assigned to it. On these facts, with the guidance of Jacobs, it is clear that the district court properly denied appellant's motion. And I guess if we look at the record of the district court, too, the district court had this case for nearly 4 years. The court made numerous important rulings that both favored appellants and favored respondents at various times. For example, the district court awarded appellants their attorney fees following a deposition dispute in September 22. In October of 2022, the district court granted appellants' third request for reconsideration of an earlier motion to compel. The district court initially denied the appellant's motion, denied their first request, denied their second request for reconsideration, but then their third request was granted following the Minnesota Supreme Court's decision in Energy Policy Advocates v. Ellison. So these cases, well, I guess in the last one, the district court even awarded appellants discovery-related sanctions against respondent Sean Stevenson in December of 2022. All of those decisions were made during the time when Mr. Morrison was on this file. And these are not the decisions of a biased court. They are the product of a judge objectively weighing each motion on the merits, regardless of the moving party. This procedural record alone defeats the argument that impartiality could be reasonably questioned by a fully informed examiner. With respect to the comments about Otter Tail County being a small district, going back to January 2021, respondents had moved for a change of venue. Appellants fought that motion, and at the very first hearing on that motion to quash a change of venue is when Attorney Hansen announced that retired Judge Hansen was her father. Judge Miller, in our case, deemed it not a conflict, and despite knowing that Attorney Hansen was the daughter of retired judge in Otter Tail County, appellants fought to keep the case in Otter Tail County and litigated it for 4 years. Now, only after 4 years of litigation, after exhausting their appeals, do they suddenly claim that the judge they fought to keep is somehow disqualified. Rule 211 is not a mechanism to resurrect dead cases. As far as vacature is concerned, if this court were to consider that there is an appearance of partiality here, I think Judge Miller's comment and his decision is well-founded. The Minnesota Supreme Court has never held that an appearance of bias requires automatic reversal. Instead, the court applies a three-factor Powell test to determine when reversal is warranted. Here, this case has already been up to the Court of Appeals. It's been affirmed by the Court of Appeals. The petition review was denied. Vacature would only serve to prolong this already very lengthy proceeding. It would do nothing. It would change the outcome of the case. The facts don't change. The law doesn't change. If this court were to ever reach the conclusion that district court's partiality could be questioned, vacature is absolutely not appropriate on these facts. Unless you have any further questions for me, Your Honors, I will.
Thank you. Do you know other questions?
Thank you.
Thank you, Counsel. And Counsel for Appellant, you'll now have 5 minutes for rebuttal. Can I ask you, Counsel, but at the beginning of your rebuttal, in response to Judge Smith's earlier question, do you recognize a distinction between a judge giving notice of some knowledge of a party or a member of a party versus an obligation of a judge to have to recuse or consider him or herself disqualified? And part of the reason I ask that is I served for over 24 years in a county that's smaller than Otter Tail County, a one-judge county, and very often I had some knowledge, either the party or if it was a corporation, perhaps a member of the corporation, because I was fairly active in the community. And I was doing that just to let the parties know. I didn't necessarily feel I had an obligation to recuse. But that seemed to be your answer to Judge Smith's question of a former law clerk. If it's 5 years later and I give the parties notice that by the way, counsel for such and such used to clerk for me, does that obligate me to recuse?
Starting with your question, Your Honor, no, it doesn't obligate you, but it does obligate you to disclose. And in this case, there was no disclosure of Clerk Morrison's relationship. I want to just address a few different things.
Just follow up? But if a party objected, I heard you tell me that then there is an obligation to recuse.
I think the court goes through the same exact analysis as we're going through here right now. A reasonable, objective, unbiased layperson understanding the duties and responsibilities of your clerk would undoubtedly question whether the district court or you would be in a different situation would be biased. So the question for the court is that standard, that appearance of bias, satisfied? That's not an issue before this court in this appeal, because here it wasn't disclosed. It wasn't given to the parties so that they could actually make that decision. So we never got to the point where someone should say, yes, I should recuse, or no, I should not recuse. But we do still have the same standard. The standard is, did this undisclosed relationship taint? And the answer from a reasonable, unbiased observer, understanding all the facts, would be yes, it did taint. The law clerk's relationship to Judge Hansen, the intimate connection, and I want to address again, Your Honor.
Zero relationship between the attorney and the law clerk.
We don't know. We have affidavits.
There's no evidence of any relationship, and she represented that she had no recollection of ever even meeting him.
Yeah, and we have no way of rebutting that because we had no opportunity to ask Clerk Morrison any questions. We had Judge Miller going out and investigating on his own, looking into the record, asking questions, and then bringing it into this proceeding. The Malone case indicates that that is off limits. You're not allowed to do that as a judge. We preserved this issue by arguing it before we made the motion. We preserved this issue by making this appeal. We had no obligation to object to Judge Miller's face and say, you're bringing in something that's not appropriate. Our opportunity was to error correct through this court, which is why we are here asking for an error correcting decision.
Would you agree there's no duty to disclose if there's no duty to be disqualified or recuse oneself?
If there's no duty to recuse, I think it's a different standard because the standard that a court has to go through is not just is recusal a problem from my perspective as a judge looking at the rule. The question is a reasonable observer understanding all the facts, is that person going to believe that there's been a taint in the process, the taint in the decision-making? And here...
But isn't that's kind of what I'm asking. If a judge having knowledge of what the judge knows and thinks no reasonable person, because I'm reasonable and no reasonable person would find it, there'd be no notice, we don't get then to...
But it's a different analysis. We don't have Judge Hansen here. We don't have Clerk Morrison. We have Judge Miller. Judge Miller did not clerk for Judge Hansen. It was Judge Miller's law clerk who had the relationship. And that relationship, that court family relationship that exists between a judge and a law clerk, Ms. Hansen is part of Judge Hansen's actual family. Clerk Morrison was part of his court family at the courthouse.
I am trying to understand. I had the exact question. You're suggesting there's two standards. Let's just say a reasonable appearance of bias is one standard where a judge should recuse. But you're saying even before the judge gets to deciding whether there would be a reasonable appearance of bias and that they have to disclose a contact. That's what I heard you say in response to my question. You don't get to that second question until you've first given notice. What is the giving notice requirement if it's not based on, what provides that? What is a standard for when you have to give notice as a judge?
It's different and it's fact-based. Every case is different.
Well, the facts are different, but what's a standard for the court to employ in saying, in these facts, I need to give notice, even though I haven't yet decided whether a reasonable person would find...
I can't give it based on a hypothetical. All I can tell you is that if you look at the facts of this case, if you read our briefs, if you read the reply, if you read the opposition, there is no way to get around the appearance of impropriety or bias in this case. This is a practical problem for this court. I understand. We are coming with an uphill practical problem, but the importance of an unbiased, untainted decision is too great. And if this court has to do the difficult thing, we ask it to do the difficult thing at this level. Thank you, Your Honors. We ask that you remand and reverse the order for disqualification and direct vacation of the 12 orders issued written by Clerk Morrison. Thank you.
Thank you to both counsel. We appreciate your answers to our questions this morning as well as your briefing. We will now take the matter under advisement. We'll be issuing a ruling within 90 days. Have a good day.